Well, I just want to deepen our theme now of longing and resistance on the spiritual path. The Buddha said, there is no bliss higher than peace. Again, peace is this state where we feel whole. We are not in conflict with ourselves. We're not in conflict with the world. And we've been designed to be turbo, kind of primed for greed, aversion, and delusion, the three mind states that confuse us the most, muddy the waters the most. So we're primed for that on the one hand. But on the other hand, we are primed for rest and ease of heart, ease of well-being. So you can hear spiritual masters talking about peace a lot. So Ajahn Chah was the teacher of Jack Kornfield when Jack Kornfield was a monk back in the late 60s, early 70s. And he was one of the main teachers in the 20th century in the Thai forest tradition. And the Thai forest tradition really revitalized meditation within Buddhism in Thailand. There was a lot of more just kind of scholarly approaches or not much meditation in the city monasteries. In the forest monasteries around the turn of the 20th century, they really brought back meditation practice. And so the practice that teachers teach through Insight Meditation Society or Spirit Rock, which is where my lineage comes from, you know, owe a lot to the revitalization of meditation in Thailand, as well as Burma, right around the turn of the 19th into the 20th century. And Ajahn Chah was one of the renowned teachers in the lineage. And I was a temporary novice monk for 3 months in one of his monasteries in Thailand. It was an amazing experience. And Ajahn Chah had a way of putting things very directly and simply. And so he's very well known for this quote. And at the monastery where I was, they just had all these little sayings of Ajahn Chah's tacked up all over the place on trees out in the forest. So you'd be walking along and you stumble across this little gem. He said, if you let go a little, you'll have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you'll have complete peace. And so a story Jack likes to tell about being with Ajahn Chah is they were walking through the forest once, and there was this big, huge boulder in the woods, and Ajahn Chah said to Jack, see that boulder? Jack's like, yeah. Do you think it's heavy? Jack said, of course it's heavy, it's huge. And Ajahn Chah said, not if you don't pick it up. That is peacefulness. And he's talking about what we're talking about today. Past and future are optional. We can let go. And the peace we taste is the peace that we get from being right here in the present moment. It's the boulder, the burden of the past is heavy, heavy, heavy. The burden of the future, heavy, heavy, heavy. And it's optional. again, it's just a thought world we're creating. And we need to create thought worlds and have a very loose, very general approximation of what actually was or is or will be. We can never get better than that with our thoughts. Loose, very roughly aligned with reality. But we never know exactly how it's going to be. Never. Even when we have a general sense, we don't really know moment to moment what it's going to be like. So we want to use thinking mind when it's useful, and when it's not, just drop it like a hot potato. We can. It's an option. Drop the boulder. And this is peacefulness. We just naturally kind of back into well-being when we let go like this. So and this peacefulness is not passive. It's not spacey. It's bright. It's where spontaneous, appropriate action comes from. It comes from our peacefulness, because in our peacefulness, we're seeing how things are clearly. And when we see clearly, we know how to act. Until we see clearly, it's hard to know what to do. So this peacefulness is bright and active and clear. But there's something just beautiful and restful about this notion of peacefulness. So when I was at Wapananachat, and Wat is monastery, Pa, I think, is forest, and Nanachat, I forget, but it's a forest monastery at Nanachat. And Wat Pa Pong is where Ajahn Cha, was where he was based. And that was his monastery, about 5 miles away from Nanachat. And he developed Nanachat to be a place where Westerners could come and train. And I was there. I practiced for free. I only ate once a day, and I didn't have any belongings, so to speak, in the monastery. I was fed every day by the villagers nearby, the rice farmers, basically. So it was incredibly precious, this opportunity to go practice in Thailand for free. You can still do it. And so this is this beautiful part of the tradition. But the emphasis was on peacefulness. And we called it Samana Dhamma, the way of peace. And so I went and I had an audience with Ajahn Liam towards the end of my stay. I just kind of wanted to ask him about my life direction. And it was very spooky. He's a very advanced practitioner. And if you're a monk or a nun, you do a 3-month retreat every year in the traditional rains retreat. I don't know how many decades he's been in robes, but 30, 40 years. 3-month retreat every year, plus this intense renunciation. It's a powerful form, the monastic form. And talking to him about my life direction was spooky, because I asked him a question about my path in life. And he pretty much referenced my practice. He spoke directly from the practice I was doing in the monastery. He had no clue what my practice was. But he started his answer by referring to my practice, which is all about noticing that the body is totally out of your control. And he said, well, just like the body is out of your control, so is your life. And then he just went to, you know, give me some advice about how to navigate life when so much is out of control. But I really felt like, oh boy, he's reading my mind, and it was a little spooky. But the quality that I noticed right away in him when I met him, he was clearing brush in part of the monastery, and so he just sauntered back to the sala, the meditation hall, where he was going to sit down with me and talk, and he was so peaceful. It was just, they say in Thailand, sabai sabai, which is sort of like our, it's all good. So this guy was radiating sabai sabai. It was this force, you could say, of peace. And if you've ever been around Thich Nhat Hanh, you can pick up on that in him. He exudes this presence, you know, in a large room, you know, of thousands of people. You can feel his peacefulness. So active, bright peacefulness. So what we make peace with, essentially, partially as we let go of relentless thinking, we're dropping the burden of past and future. That's very peaceful. And then we go further. What we drop is our argument with how things are. We're not peaceful in our hearts. We're restless in our hearts because we're spending much of our energy resisting what's happening. Michelle McDonald, a Vipassana teacher, said, you know, one of her students wrote her and says, the more mindful I am, the more I'm just amazed is that I'm spending my entire day resisting what is. And that's tiring. And it's restless. Our hearts are restless because we can't just take life as it is. And this doesn't mean we don't act. We do act. But we act from the clarity of peacefulness. And then our actions are well calibrated to the situation. But we have to make peace with what is. And the Buddhist teachings are a real shortcut. And most Buddhist teachers in the West are not asking anyone to become Buddhist. We're asking you to hear the teachings and then check it out in your own life. And if it works for you, then whatever you are is what you are. You might call yourself Buddhist, you might not. But the main thing is you see what works. And what I find so great about the tradition is it's so simple. The Buddha boiled down our complex lives and the complex ways we suffer into something so simple. And his simplicity was to say that we suffer because we base our happiness on pleasantness. We don't know how to be happy unless something pleasant, positive, good is happening. We don't know how to be happy when things are just kind of neutral. We don't know how to be happy, especially when things are unpleasant, not going our way. So there's nothing wrong with happiness based on the pleasant. When the pleasant comes, we're naturally happy. So that's fine. We don't want to change that at all. It's the other two we really need to work on. We need to know how to be happy when it's just blah. And we need to be happy, know how to be happy when it's like, ugh. So this is the crux issue of being human. This is the human condition, is we base our happiness on pleasure. And the whole tradition of Buddha Dharma is one that says, actually, there's a more reliable happiness. We can be happy when things aren't going our way. We can be happy when it's just mashed potatoes on the plate, kind of bland, kind of neutral. And then this is unassailable happiness, because pleasant, unpleasant, neutral is the crux of the matter. How we're relating to that determines everything about how we're doing. And again, the Buddha made it so simple. Every experience has one of three flavors: pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. You can't argue with that. A sight, a sound, a sensation, a taste, a smell. Those are the five physical senses. The mind, memories, thoughts are the sixth sense in Buddhism. Every single experience is either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And there, our experiences are happening like this. Everything is changing very quickly. And everything is changing between pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And we're going around like this, like a whirligig beetle in the water, because we only want the pleasant, and that's where we can rest. But then the pleasant comes along, and we just go upside down. We just, you know, we don't like it. And so when the Buddha used the word dukkha, what he was talking about, it's a coarse translation is suffering, but you know, to say life is suffering is not true. The best translation is unreliable. Our experience is unreliable because it doesn't stay pleasant. And because we're basing our happiness on pleasant, then our happiness is unreliable. It comes and goes. The best day you've ever had came and went. My best day ever as an athlete was in the finals of a soccer league, and I scored three goals out of our team's four goals, and I scored the game-winning goal with like a minute left, and I was on freaking cloud nine. This was like 20 years ago. Best day of my life as an athlete. And I had played soccer since I was 12. I finally, you know, finally you reach some nirvana of soccer. And then next game, you know, what did I do, right? I mean, it was all gone. Now, this is not to say that wasn't great, but it was. It just didn't last. And if we only fixate on the result and not the process, then I had a lot of process before reaching that peak. And it's not very happy-making to only focus on the goal, because every now and then we get results, and it's great. But we have to be focused on the whole process, and if we can be, we're much happier. So we suffer because our experience is unreliable, because we only want the pleasant. So our non-peacefulness is we want the present, pleasant, we grab it, we push away the unpleasant, and then we flat out ignore the neutral. We don't even know it's there. So notice the carpet for a second. Had you really noticed it before? It's very neutral, right? We don't usually notice the neutral. Here's the most neutral thing, space. Just notice there's space in the room. Hopefully that wasn't a yellow jacket, it was just a fly. Just check out the space. There's space in this room, the most neutral thing there is. How often do you notice space? We rarely notice it. But let's try something with space. Just sit here. I'm going to keep talking. But don't lock in on me. Let your gaze be wide. Let me be in the space that you're observing. And let your gaze be soft. So relax the eyes. And notice the space in the room. You're not grabbing objects. You're just letting this space and sight be known. It's almost like the space and the sight are coming to you. You don't have to grab. You don't have to go out. Just let it come to you. So maybe just popcorn style, if you care to, just say one word about how you're doing as you open to space. Abundant.
Relaxed.
Relax. I'm just repeating for the mic.
Options.
Liberating. Those are some pretty cool words. The part of us that's resistant doesn't like neutral. The part of us that's resistant to being awake wants pleasant, number one. But far better than neutral, after pleasant, far better than neutral is unpleasant. Because at least unpleasant, there gets to be drama. And if there's drama, then we have this sense like, I'm here. This space that you're all opening to is very neutral. And yet, just that little quick check-in, even in just a minute of doing this, you're saying things like options, relaxed, abundant. So neutral is very important to notice. We wake up out of delusion by starting to notice the neutral. So we want to notice not just object and foreground, but background, field. In my work as a therapist, and this is true for anyone who happens to work with people. Does anyone here happen to work with people? If you work with people, period. I don't mean as a therapist or a healer, right? If you work with people, which we all do, this is very helpful. When there's any challenge or any issue, just slow down, relax your eyes, and open up to the space in the room. Wherever you are, there's space. And the space, the neutral field of space, is extremely grounding when there's difficulty. So this is useful to me as a therapist. If you're a lawyer, a business person, you know, a healer, a professor, whatever you are, a tradesperson, when you're involved with people and the going gets tough, it's open to space. And you can even with that spaciousness, then it gives you this sense maybe of possibility or relaxation or abundance or options, as you all said. But what's cool about it also is you're actually clearer. You're not taking just your own side. When you open to space, you actually are making room for two people, two points of view, two different realities. And then there's something bigger than both of those, and that is this sense of space. So this is neutral. This is how we can relate it to neutral. This is the most neutral thing there is. And ego doesn't like it. The part of us that resists being awake doesn't like it, but we know better. We know that relaxing the eyes, opening to space, is really helpful. So that might be a cool practice for you to take away. Just start opening to space. Maybe when you go outside in the walking period, at some point in your walking, stop and just notice the space outside, all the way out to the sky. Big, big space. And reality is what we choose to pay attention to. If we don't choose to be aware of space, it isn't there for us. if you make a choice, you know, to drop the boulder of past and future and open to space, you're creating your own reality. We're always creating our own reality. But that's one that's going to be helpful to you. And this is all about relating to the neutral. So we normally completely miss the neutral. So what we make peace with is pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. We can say the essence of the Dharma path is making peace with that. You could say the essence of being awakened, enlightened, is you truly don't care if this moment is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. That's how free you are in your heart. Imagine that. You're at work, and if you truly don't have a preference for someone coming in the office who's a real pain in the butt versus someone coming in the office who totally gets you and is on your side versus just kind of a bland encounter. You're okay. You're equally okay in all three situations. We can actually we could say that awakening is that simple. We're truly free. And so we have a very simple map of how to be happy. What we have to make peace with is pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Greed is our reaction to pleasant that is unskillful. Aversion is our reaction to unpleasant that's unskillful. And ignoring is our reaction to neutral that's unskillful. So what do we do? How do we get happy in the midst of an unpleasant experience? The answer in this tradition is mindfulness. Mindfulness is our refuge. It is our ticket to freedom in the face of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And it's very simple. What we're all learning to do in our practice is start to pay attention. We can pay attention to pleasant. We can pay attention to unpleasant and neutral. Mindfulness doesn't care. You can know a pleasant experience just as easily as you can notice an unpleasant experience, as you can notice a neutral. Mindfulness is available. And what happens in our path, the more mindful we become, the less allegiance we have to the drama, and the more allegiance we have to mindfulness itself. And notice what happens. When a pleasant experience arises, instead of grabbing it and being like, oh no, I hope this doesn't disappear, we already can see that's tense. We just replace it with, huh, what's this like? Oh, joy. There's brightness in my heart. My posture, I feel uplifted coming up into my head. I'm noticing this. That's what we replace the greed with curiosity and awareness. And then that unpleasant person comes in the office and they start ripping you a new one over nothing. And you start noticing, instead of being like, oh God, I'm so pissed and I don't like this guy and I don't like how I feel. We replace that with, huh, what's this like? What is anger like? What is irritation like? And we notice clenching in the jaw. We notice maybe shoulders, you know, tight around the ears. We replace the reactivity, the aversion with mindfulness. And then we just went through what we do with neutral. What we do with neutral is the same thing. Ah, what's this like? What's the space in the room like? So we replace greed, aversion, and delusion with mindfulness. And that is the essence of how we unlock our restlessness. We don't need unpleasantness to disappear. We don't need pleasantness to hurry up and get here. We are actually relaxed as pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral does its dance. This is peacefulness. This is what we're after. So, it sounds great. We can actually, it's this simple. That's the entire Buddhist path right there. The way we hold it in this Theravada tradition. That's it. Making peace with pleasure and pain. It's possible. We can do it. That's what we're practicing. This practice is that. And this practice is so simple. Half a breath. We can notice half a breath, right? It's easy to notice half a breath. We just have to notice this moment. So on the one hand, this is what we long for. And the Buddha made it so simple. This is it. There's 20,000 some odd pages in the Pali Canon. You know, that's the Buddhist version of the Bible. So, but it's this simple. Make peace with pleasant, unpleasant, neutral by replacing greed, aversion, and delusion with mindfulness, period. That's what our path is. It's simple, but it's not easy. And therefore, we resist it, right? It completely goes against the grain. We want to be doing something all the time. We can call the part of us that is resistant to deep inner peace in the again, it's just words. The word in Buddhism that we use, and you hear this more in Tibetan Buddhism, is ego. Ego is that in us that is just, for whatever reason, rational or irrational, resistant to actually waking up and getting really happy. And there's nothing ego loves more than a problem. Again, we want the, like, you know, lovely quiche, you know, dripping with flavor. We'll take the pleasant. But, you know, the brown rice on the plate? No. We will take the Tabasco, the unpleasant, way before brown rice. Brown rice is way too neutral. Again, ego doesn't get to say, I'm here, in the neutral. But if there's the drama of Tabasco on your tongue, you get to incarnate and be here. You're the person that Tabasco is happening to. And then if it's pleasant, it's even better, because now you get to be here, but you get to have this pleasant experience. So that's the best from the resistance point of view. We have to understand that ego wants to do. And so therefore likes problems. You know, we'll take the joy first, but then we want the problem. So we naturally resist this simple practice of mindfulness, because it really goes against the grain. unconsciously it threatens the ego. Consciously, it's just not easy to sit down and make the time for it in your life. So that's the way we resist it in our life. We're so busy that we get to just completely rush right past our happiness all day long, because our happiness comes in being here and resting. But we're so busy rushing past it. So ego loves that, because we get to be the unhappy one. And ego isn't a thing. It's just an activity in the mind. And we don't want to be harsh on ego, because that's more ego. Trying to get rid of ego would be ego, right? We don't want to get rid of it. What we want to do instead is wake up to what's happening right now. That's all we have to do. And we're done with ego. Trungpa Rinpoche, he's always known, you know, for delivering, you know, very hardcore pithy quotes, says this about awakened mind. The attainment of enlightenment from ego's point of view is extreme death. Death of the self, death of me and mine, death of the watcher. The person here watching, the person here listening. Enlightenment is the ultimate and final disappointment. Ego is the part of us that wants to get enlightened, but ego can't get enlightened because enlightenment is the dissolving of our resistance. I'm using the words ego and resistance interchangeably. Was that a hint?
Could I ask a question?
Please, please.
In the quote, death of me, mine, and the watcher?
Yeah.
That watcher is not equivalent with awareness.
Correct. Awareness is a verb. Well, it's actually awareness is a noun. Awarenessing. Awareing, right, is what we're actually doing. Awareness is not a thing or a place, right? It's an activity. So awareness happens, watching happens. But try and find the watcher. That's different. We can have a tangible experience of watching. But when you try to find the watcher, this is actually a massive can of worms that we might want to just gingerly put over there, because it's not quite the topic, but it's a construct. It's an idea that there's a watcher. And if you try to look for the watcher, all you'll ever find is the idea of a watcher or the image of a watcher. That can't be this permanent self that we think we are, because it's a thought. And thoughts come and go like crazy. So that would mean our self is, you know, just coming and going all day long. And that's not what we think of, right? So when you look for the self, the watcher, it can't be a thought or image, because those just come and go. But when you look, that's what you find. I'm creating this sense of self continuously. So we resist it. I can remember on retreat, it was a particular few days of retreat where my mind was just having a lot of bliss-type experiences, and we can never control those. They come and go. But this was a particular, you know, quote-unquote good run. But, you know, I just remember this was just a tiny little thing in my practice, but I was doing walking meditation, and then I heard the bell ring, and I had an image of the meditation hall, and I said, ugh, not sitting. It's like, what's up with that? That's just like ridiculous resistance. It has nothing to do with the experience. If I remember the experience, it's like, right? But that's just an example of the way there's something in us that really is resisting this, even when it's blissful. And let's be really compassionate towards this ego in us. This ego part of us, whatever it is, wants happiness. But it doesn't know how to go about it. And then we look at this practice and we're like, oh, well, that sounds really simple. Right, I just become mindful, and that, and then I don't get greedy or aversive or delusive. So, oh, great. So then you try a little mindfulness, and you watch your mind, you know, do monkey mind, and like you're like, forget it. It's impossible. I can't do it. It's not true. That's just resistance. We can do it. There's a path of thousands of years of people doing this. We need to want it. The wanting it is everything. Because you will actually not give in to that part of you that says this is impossible. It isn't. It is difficult, but it isn't impossible. So here's what a very wise monk, Bhante Gunaratana, who's a Sri Lankan monk who's been in robes for probably 70 years, I don't know exactly, a long time. And he has a monastery, does anyone know, is it Virginia, West Virginia? Does anyone know? Bhavana Society? Anyway, he's written, pardon?
One or the other.
Yeah. He's written really a beautiful book called Mindfulness in Plain English, where he just is delivering pith wisdom, just page after page. I highly recommend the book. Here's what he says about this resistance. You can't ever get everything you want. It's impossible. Luckily, there's another option. You can learn to step outside the endless cycle of desire and aversion. You learn not to want what you want, to recognize desires but not be controlled by them. You want something, but you don't have to chase after it. You fear something, but you don't have to stand there quaking in your boots. This mental cultivation is very difficult. It takes years. But trying to control everything is impossible. The difficult is preferable to the impossible. This is us. This is our situation. This is what it means to be in a human form. Our lives are out of control. We can control a few things, but a lot of it out of control. This practice is an answer. And it's difficult, but it's not impossible, and that's better. We change with this practice. We become more peaceful. But we have to be willing to go slow enough. There's no magic bullet. And maybe neuroscience will discover how to like zap the brain into mindfulness. That would be awesome. But so far, not quite. Until then, we got to roll up our sleeves, and you know, it's sort of pick and shovel work. It's like, you know, you can dig a ditch or a hole if you're willing to go slow enough. If you give up after three, you know, whacks. Maybe that's not the best analogy. Let me do it slightly different. You could walk to wherever you came from, Pueblo. You know, that would take a while. But, you know, your home, if you live in Boulder, you could just walk home after our retreat. But if you started out and it took you 20 minutes to get to Valmont, you know, you'd be like, forget this. I'm going way too slow. But, you know, if your home was 5 miles away, you could get there in less than 2 hours probably. You have to be willing to go slow enough to do it, though. You have to go at walking pace. This is true of our practice. We don't take a magic bullet and just wake up into pure mindfulness. I wish it happened that way, but it doesn't. It takes practice. You have to be willing to put one foot in front of the other with your practice every day, if you can. And then we change. But if you just drop the practice because you're not seeing results fast enough, you're going to miss out. You really get more peaceful, less reactive, more clear with this practice. And I think if we're not new to the practice, that's why we're here. We know, actually, it goes somewhere. Well, this is the topic. There's so much to say, and can't get to all of it. I say just a little bit more about resistance, then I want to change the gears. The part of our mind that kind of resists the neutral space in the room, that resists doing the practice, has a lot of strategies. So doing mode is one strategy. We can be actually quite mindful while we do. So let's say doing mindlessly is a huge strategy of ego. Being hard on yourself is another big strategy, You want to stop being peaceful in a hurry? Judge yourself. another strategy that is really subtle and happens all the time is comparing mind. And this is a way we actually get to exist as kind of a separate self. It is through comparisons. And the Buddha said, whether you're comparing yourself to be equal to, superior, or inferior, he called all three conceit. Because all three are incarnating a me over here and a you over there. I'm this, but you're that. Now, this is very subtle. But we can wake up to this and... You can watch the mind do it, and then you can get that it's optional. We're social beings, so of course we compare. We actually need to. We need to know how we're sort of doing in the group. In our evolutionary past, being outside the group was life-threatening, right? You're shunned from the group. It's pretty hard to survive in, like, Paleolithic times alone. So we're very group-oriented, and the way we understand is by comparing. So we can understand that there's a good reason to compare. And yet, how's that working for you? Since it's actually not life-threatening now to be outside the group, maybe it's a little bit obsolete. Maybe it's good for your lizard brain. So one way to help let go of comparing is to understand how it works. So let's just try this. If you would, notice what you see with this flower. What do you actually see? And it's, you're far away, but just from whatever you can see, is it
a
backdrop? Okay. Okay. Now stem is something that's actually an idea, right? So that's not actually what our eye sees. What is, when you look at what we call stem, what do you see?
A stick, a straight piece of...
Okay, so shape, right? That's something that the eye takes in, so something kind of skinny and straight. Mm-hmm. What else does the eye see?
Colors.
So what colors?
Green and purple.
Okay, green and purple, okay. So now we're going to stay focused on this flower. Let's pull out this one. and stay focused on this flower, but now describe this flower. What do you notice?
Small.
Yeah. Okay. And so now describe this flower. Wow, weird. It went from small to big, depending on what? Depending on comparing. What you first named green and, you know, straight and purple, that's intrinsic. That's here regardless of where this flower is, right? But big and small depend on context, right? So, are you smart? It depends on your context. Are you fast or slow? Depends on your context. Are you tall or are you short? It depends on your context. Almost everything we think about ourselves is a comparison. And we don't actually recognize it. Our self-image is like, you know, it can be like the medium flower with the big flower. But then we feel kind of small because like we're with somebody who's better than us at something. But then we feel really good when we're with somebody who's worse. But in either case, it has nothing to do with how we intrinsically are. It has to do with our comparison. And so comparing mind is a big strategy that keeps us miserable and asleep. So ego loves doing. Ego loves problems. Ego loves comparing. So we can wake up to all of this. We're not going to judge the activity because the activity happens. We want to actually get curious about what it's like. So, comparing, doing, we already said judging. There's many strategies where we just kind of make ourselves miserable and sleepy, meaning not mindful. So there's many ways we resist. Please.
Is resistance just an illusory way of controlling them?
We think so. It's the illusion of controlling. Here's a great example. Another strategy of ego, figuring it out. Anyone do that here? Analyzing, figuring it out. I'm a former scientist. I love it. Right? It's fun, actually. but why are we figuring it out? It's a way of thinking we're going to control things, right? It's a control strategy. You know, and then sometimes we do figure something out, and it's really cool. We understand cause and effect, and, you know, we then align with it. It's not the same thing as controlling it. We just align with it. As a friend of mine said, a wise friend, the more I practice, the less in control I think I am. When we start seeing clearly, we see that there's a lot happening completely out of your control. The weather, you know, the clouds come through, the storms come through, and then the sky's clear and it's bright and sunny. And I'm just talking about your mind. We don't control our minds. We don't control our bodies. You know, our bodies are just, you know, do this dance of sensation. We have a kind of secondary control. We can cut our hair, we can brush our teeth, but our bodies are basically otherwise doing their thing. Like, did you control how tall you were going to become? Did you control, you know, what hair color you came out with? Did you control? There's so much you don't control. Right now, out of your control, you're turning the universe into you. Today's lunch. So a lot is out of our control. And it's good news because it means that we get to let go. And when we let go, we're peaceful. So we resist. But what we need to then do is get that the longing is stronger than the resistance. We don't want to wake up, and we do want to wake up. But the longing, if we can actually not be embarrassed, if we can actually get through our nourishment barrier and realize we really want to be happy, we want to be able to sort of go for it. And, you know, one Tibetan teacher says, you know, why not use this life, this precious gift of being alive, and it's so precious, we just got given this gift, and then we don't know when it ends. That's how precious it is. It's all gravy because we've been given the biggest gift already, and that's just being here. So why not use this precious life for enlightenment? Don't be embarrassed. Don't be shy. Why not? Why not use this life to go for the best possible happiness, the most reliable happiness? Why not? But you have to allow that something in you really wants that and not be embarrassed about it. Am I using embarrassment like shame? Good question. I think it's more, I'm using it like fear, actually. I think we might be afraid to admit how much we want it because it's risky. Or we might look foolish, or, you know, we might stumble around. I think there's maybe some fear. But that could certainly be a part of it, yeah. This longing is important because it's going to bring you back. If you like being mindful, really admit that to yourself. Because knowing you want it will help you organize your life so that you do it. But if you kind of say, well, it kind of works, but you haven't admitted to yourself how much it actually works for you, you know, you're not going to be as motivated. So in the Sufi tradition, like devotion and longing are seen for God in the theistic tradition. The longing is everything. And Rumi said something along of the lines is, don't seek water, seek the thirst. And then the water will come. So let it be okay. Let it not be so risky to admit to yourself that you're longing for deep peace. That when you really look at your life, you can boil it down to that. That's what you're doing. And, you know, we can have different flavors. There can be a love flavor, you know, a joy flavor, a enthusiasm flavor, an excitement flavor. There's many different flavors, but it all comes down to something that settles us and helps us get nourished. If you want to overcome the nourishment barrier, get into the present moment. And then you're happy, just because. So let me just stop and see if there's input, questions, comments.
So give us an example of how the process works, taking some sort of, like starting with the ego and how they create problems and how you can kind of work with that and being more mindful. Does that make sense?
Sure. And again, for the mic, is give an example of how the process works. If I'm hearing you, essentially how mindfulness kind of like moves through ego or beyond ego. So the way we do it is we start right where we are. Ego is always wanting something else. So what we wake up to is the activity of wanting something else. So that would be desire. So the way the process works is we wake up to right here. Whatever's happening, all we're going to do is notice what's happening. That is the process. That is how, over time, we wake up. And we don't want to resist the resistance. We want to actually accept resistance. So we start right where we are. However we are, we don't have to change anything. All we have to do is notice what's happening. And that's everything. And as I said before, short moments, many times. We need to do this many, many times. But we do a little check-in. Oh, it's like this. Oh, wanting, wanting, wanting is like this. Please, right? It's tight, right? So over time, what magically happens through this practice is we decondition our suffering habits. Over time, when these just get seen in mindfulness, they lessen. It just works. It's cool. So in the moment, we're mindful. And that's all we have to do. But over time, that mindfulness done many, many times, it decreases our reactivity. And we get more mindful and less reactive, less egoic. Does that make sense, Pat?